Hello, we are now live.
Hello.
If I press the right buttons. And hopefully my mic works today, because I didn't get the big one, I get the small one, because I tend to talk past the mic every single time. So let's start with introductions. Let's start on the my right-hand side, your left-hand side.
Rich Lander, I work on .NET Runtime.
I'm Will Landroth, I work on the .NET library side, I guess.
Philip Carter, I work on F# and .NET languages stuff.
I'm Jared Parsons. I work on the C# compiler team.
So I would like to say that yesterday I talked to someone from the C++ team, and they always cringe when they say you work on the compiler. It's like, you only have like a third of a compiler.
They're just jealous that we work on a language that has rules and a defined implementation.
This is a great opening. So today we're doing our languages in runtime a community stand-up. So you can ask any questions about languages, the runtime, the framework side, you know, .NET 5. Like, we announced a bunch of stuff at Build. Like, last week we already talked a little bit about what the Build announcements were. I talked for, I think, 15 minutes, but I got the impression that people would like to see more stuff and ask more detailed questions. So feel free to ask on YouTube, Twitch, I think even on Facebook. Jesus, you can even ask on Facebook.
This is awesome. I didn't know that. So James is saying that I look very tired. So I was just on the East Coast. So I just got back to the West Coast a couple of nights ago. So I'm still tired.
Rich doesn't drink coffee either.
So. No, I only drink tea. So
only what the Queen approved.
I only like stuff from leaves.
That leaves room for more stuff than just tea.
And I can totally tell that Imo is the one who is the restream.io. Person, just because those are the same smileys that he uses for everything.
Yes,
I use. Okay. Even though he's a millennial, technically.
Okay, how about
millennials
we get to
are like by law
slightly
not
more topical
in their smileys?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like a law thing.
Oh, cool.
Okay,
I learned something new today.
So, since we don't have any questions yet, what are we gonna talk about?
Yeah, so what I had in mind is, like, we just do a quick summary of what happened at Build again, so that because I don't think anybody watched last week. And there's some, you know, small features that maybe worthwhile talking about. So how about we start with the big elephant in the room, if I find the right button again?
I mean, that looks complicated.
Big elephant button.
You have no idea, man.
Is that the big, you press the big elephant button.
I pressed the elephant button. And Philip, there's this icon here that flashes. Don't press that one.
Okay.
just so we're clear.
That's the dumbest icon in the world.
Lithium battery explosion. Okay.
Remember the one time where Philip ended the stream 10 minutes in?
Yep. Okay.
No, it's all fine. It's just my laptop went to sleep.
.NET Core is the future of .NET by Scott Hunter.
Yes. So in this post, if you haven't read it yet, the key summary is, it should not be surprising for most people who follow us, that most of our investment goes towards .NET Core. We have already slowed down over the last years the churn in .NET Framework, and basically this post just reaffirms our position on this one, and .NET Framework is still supported, and we will support it basically as long as Windows is supported, which is to say a very long time. And so basically that means all new investments, new language features, new library innovations will go to .NET Core exclusively.
Right, and by most, I think we mean something on the order of 90% of our effort goes to .NET Core. It's that kind of most.
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at the releases that we did over the last years, I mean, it was already somewhat visible anyways.
Right, and then the other part of this is .NET Framework 4.8 is the last significant release of the .NET Framework. Like, we don't even have plans to do a .NET Framework 4.8.1, like .NET Framework 4.8. That's the last one. But it'll be good for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about what our bar is. I mean, we will still make fixes to it, and sometimes it may even include feature work, but the feature work will only be from the lens of, like, is this required to keep existing apps working, right? So the example that always comes up is TLS 1.3, and if there's a 1.4, 1.5 kind of thing, then we would probably have to do something to make sure that apps can still continue to connect to servers on the internet.
Right. The good thing with that particular one is .NET Framework relies almost exclusively on the underlying machinery in Windows. I think it's this S channel thing. And so mostly we're good on that front. But yes, probably some small tweaks.
Some small tweaks, yes. You guys want to add to anything at all?
I mean, certainly from the F# perspective, .NET Core has been the future of .NET for a while. That's where we've almost put, like, pretty much every single innovation in. We've pretty much frozen .NET framework-based tooling for F#, and we're going to be pushing that even harder. I mean, I think the upcoming version of F# is not going to be tied to .NET Core in any way, just because we're not actually going to be shipping anything that is intrinsic to .NET Core. But I expect something similar to F#4.5, where we do have .NET Core technologies being shipped. I expect more of that to happen in the future. So, yeah.
So, contrasting with F#, like C# actually now does have features which will only work on .NET Core compatible runtimes, like for instance, default interface methods. And that's something where we're talking about where we're not going to do as much innovation in the desktop framework. This was a fairly significant feature for the runtime to uptake, and that doesn't kind of meet our bar going back to desktop. And so this is a feature that's only going to work on .NET Core. And as Philip said, like I imagine that as we kind of move forward in C#, we're going to see more and more of that. If you look at the types of things that we are considering for C# 9, for instance, we've done a lot of talking about like new primitive types, like some like half floats, double floats,
yep,
native ints, things like that. Some of these things, like they're only going to work on .NET Core because there's just no feasible path for them back into the framework. And I think if you look further and further out, you're going to see that that needle is moving more in that direction.
Yeah, I think the last time we bumped the runtime for language work was Whitby, right? 2005.
The generics is basically the last big one. There was a small bump when we did Nopia embedded interop types. There's a small little bump in the runtime for that, but that is fairly minor.
Yeah.
Right. So async enumerable, I think, is another example that probably more people would be touched by than DIM, maybe.
Yeah. That's another one. Yeah. I mean, there's, if you look at it in terms of like the features we've done, which actually have dependencies in .NET Core, you go through our index range support, async enumerable, default interface methods. Those are all fairly tied to changes we did in .NET Core.
Right. So, I mean, some people might be, I mean, there's kind of two ways of, I think, interpreting this change in strategy. One is like, oh, you know, I'm a .NET framework user, so I'm less than pleased that I'm not getting these features in the .NET implementation that I'm using. The other view of it is like, oh my God, look at how much, you know, new work and new innovation and new features collectively across, you know, language, runtime, and framework that we're able to do because we can focus just on .NET Core going forward. So if you're on .NET Core, this is amazing news because we're able to unlock a ton of value and also make much more aggressive changes than we traditionally made on .NET Framework.
Exactly. I mean, it's actually been kind of took a while for the compiler team to kind of change their mindset of, let's think about how we design things as the runtime is this static thing that we can't really evolve very well,
right,
to, oh, let's go find that backlog of ideas that we all kind of threw in the trash because we knew the runtime would never change. And now it's like getting those ideas back on the table, getting kind of our mind in the, hey, let's go talk to the runtime people. They can actually help us like move forward now, and we can actually do better optimizations, better code gen. So,
well, it also turns out they put you in a team room with the runtime people. So literally,
they made me sit next to Jan, and his punishment this morning was helping me debug app domains.
I saw that. I came in this morning. I saw you too. I thought this cannot be good.
No.
Okay.
Fun topic.
Next post.
So the evolution from that is then basically you wrote it, right? So you should talk about that.
Yeah, Rich.
Yeah, totally. So this one is introducing .NET 5. So this is basically saying what the next version of .NET Core is going to be, and we are going to, like, if you think about the .NET Core 3.0 release, we took the remaining set of kind of .NET framework functionality that we thought was a good idea to put on .NET Core, so that was WPF and Windows Forms. So that's the 3.0 release. The 5.0 release is basically taking all the Xamarin workloads, so that's primarily mobile, but also some gaming stuff, and making that work in the .NET Core ecosystem as well. So that's one piece of it. The second piece of it is, all .NET projects now are going to have a single personality. We're going to use SDK style projects for everything. .NET tools on the command line will work for all projects. And then also you'll have a choice of two different runtimes to use, either the, you know, Core CLR JIT oriented runtime or the Mono AOT runtime. So if you want to just like single XE native code, distribution. And so, yeah, that will give you a lot of choice. And we feel like moving forward, this will be a great story. So it will allow us to kind of more readily compete in more spaces. The other thing is, like, up until now, like the Mono Xamarin products, we're using kind of this, a bit of some of CoreFX, but also some parts of their own code. And so now we're just going to be using CoreFX for literally everything going forward. So it means you will get the exact same behavior by construction for all apps. So we think this is a major step forward. And we're planning to deliver the .NET 5 project in November 2020. And I just want to answer one question that has constantly come up, which is, it's like, oh, you know, if I have a .NET framework project, can I just like flip something and then I'll be able to target .NET 5? And the answer is no. You should think of, if you're starting from .NET framework, you should think of targeting .NET 5 in exactly the same way as you think of targeting .NET Core 3.0. Because we don't intend to bring any additional .NET framework functionality in the .NET 5 timeframe. So it's going to be the same as .NET Core 3.0 from that particular perspective. So you have to do a manual porting exercise. But it's gotten so much better since the early days when it was quite challenging, mostly because of bad decisions you made.
Yeah, bad decisions my team made. going back to the Frankenbuild of the frameworks that we have today, like, I mean, if you look at the evolution of the of .NET Standard and portable class libraries, it's kind of like showcasing, you know, the fragmentation that we had. And you know, we've worked really heavily with everybody, you know, that it doesn't work for Microsoft, like the Xamarin guys before we acquired them, the Unity people, and we really tried very hard to remove this notion of patching this, you know, inconsistent worldview, right? We really wanted to get everybody on the same board. That's why we did the standard. But it's more like a, you know, standard is still useful when you think of, you have different implementations, and now we're basically saying, wouldn't it be nice if we actually had unified implementations so that when you submit a PR and it gets accepted, it basically lights up next time somebody just produces a build rather than somebody has to take that API and copy and paste it somewhere else, right? The one thing I wanted to comment on, though, because I had a typical conversation with some people, and there seems to be a lot of doubt in the community about whether we can do this at all, which surprises me a little bit, because they basically said, like, you know, you have talked about this for a long time and it never happened. And I don't quite understand that, because if you look at the actual implementation today, if you look at Mono, they actually do copy and paste effectively the CoreFX sources already.
About a third, I think, of their
Steven said, like, it's a third reference source, a third of their own code, and then a third of CoreFX today.
It's about that.
And so I think from our point of view, they already have prototypes working where they basically take CoreFX, take the Mono runtime, and throw them together and have things boot. So it's not like this pipe dream that somebody, you know, scribbled on a whiteboard. This is actually backed by the actual engineering plan and, you know, actual tangible things you already do. So.
And exactly, like in our own repo, we actually, like the C# compiler, we run all of our tests on like desktop, CoreCLR, and Mono, and we're doing exactly that today,
right.
And it presents almost no difficulty for us.
Yeah, I also don't think that we claimed, so we've published lots of diagrams that look very similar to this in the past.
Yes.
So maybe there was some confusion, and I definitely apologize if that's the case, but the thing that we are proposing to do in this .NET 5 timeframe, we actually never said before that we were trying to do. This is fundamentally a new plan that I think is quite dissimilar from anything we've done in the past.
And what we have said in the past is basically we're trying to unify more stuff, but all the unification was by shape. It was never by implementation. And I think that's the lesson learned for us, is that it makes more sense to unify implementation, because if you look at Tizen, for example, they did not fork the code base and wrote their own version of .NET. They basically took CoreFX as binaries and then put their own stuff on top. So it's a fairly successful model for us.
Well, and by shape, unifying by shape, that's basically the .NET standard approach to unification. So this is really a giant step beyond that, although the .NET standard step was a good and important and necessary one.
Yeah, it realized customer value in the phase where things are not unified yet, right?
Yeah.
So that's tangible.
Okay.
So the other thing we should briefly mention is this one here, because that's a big change as well that some people found surprising. Can you talk about this a little bit more, Rich?
Sure. I mean, I think the basic point here is a couple things. One is we haven't had uniform schedules. So, like, for example, I love the Ubuntu project because they ship every April and October, and every second April is an LTS release, and it, for them, it happens to be the even years. So it's really easy to reason about that as a downstream user of Ubuntu. So we're actually adopting something very similar here, which is we intend to ship at least every November. We certainly reserve the right to do dot releases in between. And then every second major release will be LTS, and we've chosen to go with the odd years just because of how it's lining up on the calendar. And we'll ship, we're shipping 3.0 in September, and and people often ask us, oh, when's the next LTS release? Because, you know, we ship 2.1 as LTS. So 3.1, which we hope to release by the end of the year, end of 2019, right, will be LTS. And then you see that the next LTS release will be 6.0, which is in 2021.
And I mean, the dates are also not really a surprise if you consider Microsoft's Connect conference that we've basically done since .NET Core V1. So we basically always had releases aligned with that, but we never really made official statements about this is the time frame and this is what you're getting, right? So that's, so it's mostly codifying what we already do, but basically setting expectations for everybody, I think, is a good thing.
Yep.
And this is not just like the .NET Core release, though. This is a unified release for the SDK, the tools. So when .NET Core, when we release in November, you're getting a new runtime, new SDK, new F#, new C#, like the entire tool set is coming with us. We can have this nice regular rhythm of tooling and runtime releases.
Yeah. Actually, that might be something good for you to talk about, which is, I think in the .NET Core 3.0 timeframe, we're kind of making a shift, which is C# 8 is shipping on the .NET Core schedule now more than the Visual Studio schedule.
Yes, and that is definitely, and that's something we're going to continue in the future. Like today, if you actually download like Visual Studio 2019, C# 8 is there, but it's in preview mode. So it's, we are actually shipping the new compiler and the new features, but we essentially have everything turned off unless you have opted into the .NET Core previews and you're targeting .NET Core 3.0. And I think going forward, that's what we expect to do, is that C# is going to be a little more tied to the .NET runtime. And whatever we will ship in the Visual Studios that are there at that time, and we will continue doing what we're doing today, where it'll be the new compiler and the new features, but they'll all be hidden behind the preview flag.
Right. And I think it's fair to say this setup is where we feel like we can deliver the maximum value.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And what's actually really nice is by tying it to us and allowing us to have this little preview bridge, like, we're frankly very excited about that, because it answers a question that we've had for a long time, which is, how do we get new versions of the language out there to the most people before RTM, so that people can essentially just set a flag, try some things out, give us feedback, tell us what's good about this, what's bad about this, and we can iterate fast.
Right, but we also reserve the right to make changes.
Oh, absolutely. That's why it's that's why the language version is preview. we might change. It's we're going to change.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So let's look at some questions, because there's some things that it's a bit all over the place, but I think that's just the nature of questions. One question is very specific. Does concurrent dictionary get or add method, is that thread safe or not? Like, I'm pretty sure the idea of the method is to be atomic, at least, right? So that, depending on what you mean by thread safe.
But I assume that the user there is referring to the overload, which takes a delegate. Because concurrent dictionary in general is always data safe. Like, you can't, there's no way to call the methods on dictionary from a bunch of different threads and corrupt the internal data structure.
Because that's kind of its whole
point. Yeah, that's the entire purpose. The get or add method, though, one overloads takes essentially a delegate which produces the eventual value. I believe the question is whether or not that is called one time or multiple times.
I see.
And my understanding is that delegate can be invoked multiple times, but it's pretty clearly documented if you check the docs on that.
Right, though. But that, even if it's called multiple times, that doesn't seem to take away from thread safety, because it's all a question of basically, can it do a dirty read or a dirty write? Right? That's my take on this, and the answer should be no.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not going to...
I think the question is, what code can you write in a delegate? You basically have to assume your code is not atomic, right? So that, like, if that violates your thread safety, then that's bad. But I think the idea of this is basically you produce the value, we do need a lock compare exchange or something along those lines, and then if you know we may have to call the app method again, I guess. Sorry, the factory method again. Will DIMMs be in, or default interface methods, will this be in .NET standard? There's still the PR open, we're still debating whether we add it or not. The answer might be yes or no, but it doesn't mean that we
could
will.
Could it be anything other than yes or no?
So all I'm saying is we don't know yet, right? Like,
sorry, I will not troll again.
Deep,
sorry.
Deep insight.
Well.
Can you, just to provide some flavor on that, can you give one or two aspects of what's making it difficult for you to make that decision?
So the discussion that we have right now is that if you look at DIMMs, there's only two aspects to it. One of them is, if I compile against .NET standard, will the compiler let me author my own DIMMs? Right, that's one aspect. The other thing is, will we use DIMMs within the standard itself? Like, will we actually define default members on interfaces? Right. We know the answer to the second one. The second one is going to be no. Like, this release will not do any of that work probably, because there's no plan to do that. But the first one, basically, we're considering allowing you to do that. And that is mostly a function of like, okay, can we get all the runtime people that implement .NET standard to agree that, oh yeah, if the compiler lets you create those, are we okay with loading that code successfully, right? And there's some disagreement around that nature right now, I think.
Right, so my understanding from overhearing some of these conversations is it's these concerns have relatively little to do with schedule, meaning about getting a certain amount of work done in a certain time frame. It's more about we haven't quite kind of navigated through all the potential bad things that could happen.
Right.
Yeah.
So it will come eventually. I mean, it's in core 3.0, which means it's also in core 5.0, obviously, or .NET 5.0.
Right. So if people want to do a little bit of research on this, there's this diamond pattern thing.
Yeah.
Is that what they should look on?
Well, there's this diamond thing, and then there is the, I think the question that most people have is, what's the scenario for it? And one of the key drivers for us was better interop with Java, where basically they use DIMMs in the same way that, you know, we ended up using, I guess, extension methods on our interfaces, right? So it's a pretty heavy use on their end. Compared on our side, it would be more targeted right now. But you could imagine that, you know, we will evolve interfaces more aggressively if we have that tool. What's worth pointing out, though, is like we will only have support for C# right now, right? There's nothing lined up for F# or VB.
On the F# side, we're planning on, for the .NET Core 3 release, to be able to consume DIMMs, but not actually produce them. We don't feel that producing them is like in line with the goals of F#, but you know, we're kind of open to feedback on that. We just want to make sure that if we see one, we don't explode.
That's a good strategy. So some questions were regarding SQL Server Management Studio, sorry, SQL Server Reporting Services and other things, which I don't think anybody in the room actually has context to answer that.
Same for X++, I'm guessing.
Well, I think the short version, so I don't actually know the answer to this question, but I'll still give one, which is...
That sounds like a very reasonable way to get fired. It was nice working with you.
Yeah, exactly. I would suspect that, you know, many of these tools, and Visual Studio is an example of this, will continue being primarily .NET framework oriented until they actually make some kind of significant announcement about being more .NET core oriented. So I don't think I certainly haven't talked to that team about a big switch to .NET core.
Yeah, I don't know what their plans are. I mean, like, what is true though is that if you look at the larger partners like SharePoint, Exchange, and all the other ones that are, you know, pretty sizable in terms of lines of code, almost all of them already talked to us about porting parts to .NET core, if not all of it. It's more like a function of when, I guess, not if, would be my guess.
Sure.
X++, I don't even know what it is.
I know what it is, yeah, but it's...
I remember what it is.
It's used in like Office Dynamics.
Yeah. Oh, I remember that now. Yes.
But I don't know what their plan is for .NET Core.
Dynamics is another team that we've been talking to about .NET Core. So I think they are putting a plan together. I don't know exactly how X++ fits into that, but needless to say, the Dynamics team has definitely heard about .NET Core and they're making a plan around it.
Yeah. Awesome. Somebody's asking about how they bind textbox two-way using F# records to the MIUI.
Like F# is generally, I mean, you can. It's just you have to register. I mean, you have. you wouldn't use F sharp records. You would use a class the way that you would do it in C sharp. But keep in mind, there's no like proper UI support for that. Like, or rather, I should say, there's no proper designer support. So, I mean, my advice if you're doing anything with WPF is you do it with C sharp and you call into F sharp code if you want to use F sharp.
F sharp libraries.
Yeah. It can be a relatively thin UI layer.
Presumably you could data bind model classes that were written in F sharp.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way that you hook up the data binding is the part that is more C sharp oriented.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's and you know, if you're fine with no designer support, then you could absolutely do that in F sharp. It's generally easier to do it with a class. There's also a question about new WinUI. I don't really know what the new WinUI is because I wasn't paying attention for any of that.
Emo's been looking into that.
Yeah, we had a conversation with them the other day.
From what I understand, it's a high level plan. Like, you know, there's no like concrete bits that you can use that are like all the, you know, the whole unified thing.
Right.
So I think at this point it's too premature to talk about where F sharp would lie in that.
But I mean, XAML like is more than, I mean, WPF XAML would be the same thing, right? Like you have the same problems, I guess. It's not just the WinRT version of XAML.
I don't even see that question.
Which one?
Where's the question on WinUI?
I scrolled past it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. I think there's one question regarding Azure Functions in F Sharp. Do you know anything about that?
When will templates arrive in Visual Studio 2019? Short answer, I don't know. Whenever they arrive.
Yeah.
It's not a top priority for us at this time. I know that some of the templates are set up, but there's still more work on the Azure Functions tooling side to make it a good experience. Like, you could plop some of that into Visual Studio today, but it would not really be that good. So I think it's better to just not have it in Visual Studio as a file new experience until it's to a point where it's good enough.
Yeah, where we're confident.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can use F sharp itself, but it's basically like the within their tools, they don't have a way to like add a new file to an item group yet, and like basically the project system can do that, but the Azure Functions tools can't yet, and so that needs to get solved because file ordering matters for F sharp, and so without that, it's sort of like in a weird state, and so we don't want to put that in Visual Studio at that time.
That makes sense. I like how the people are trolling each other in the
a little bit of trolling in there.
So while I have you, Jared, any decision on pro enumeration cancellation support for iAsync enumerable?
Yes. So if you actually, like, we've made a couple of changes on how cancellation works for iAsync enumerable. I don't remember the exact issue, but if you go to C# lang and you look for the async enumerable proposal, we're pretty careful to link all the language design notes which relate to it. If you look at the most recent one, it'll have all of the like crisp details on what we did for async enumerable. But in summary, what it comes down to is kind of on your iterator methods, on your async iterator methods now, you can mark a cancellation token as I want to take this and give this to every enumerator separately, and that we will then, the compiler will do the work to kind of combine that at the for each time to make it all work. The details are a little bit hairy, which is why I'm not getting into them, but we have a pretty detailed elaboration on that in the notes. And if you have any questions on that, if you post on the issue in C# lang, I'll make sure that Julian or I follow up with you about it.
Some person is saying we should focus on the speakers. Are we that interesting?
No, definitely not.
That's what I would say too.
Okay. I mean, one of the things that we find is the level of variance in the amount of context people have is very high.
Yes.
So, you know, you talk to one person and they basically know everything and more than you. And then you talk to another one and it's like, oh yeah, I haven't been on the internet in a few years. So I'm just catching up, bring me up to speed. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just, it's very varied.
The problem is they just asked a question on GeoCities, right? So nobody reads that. No, so yesterday, I think it was yesterday, last week, I think there was somebody pinging us on Twitter and asked a question that I think never came up. And that goes back to context. That person basically said, so my boss wants to know whether I can install .NET Core and .NET Framework on the same machine.
I see. Can you go full screen on the speakers? We don't need the schedule anymore.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
They want to see our
faces. Ah. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Yeah. Okay. I'm like, we're not talking about Rich's personal tea consumption. So the question basically was, so is .NET Core and .NET Framework, and install them safely on the same box? And they said, well, there's no official documentation. And well, we never wrote any because that never occurred to us as a thing to officially say, because it seems very obvious that that's a safe
thing. We wouldn't be able to support Windows otherwise.
Exactly. So I think that's... No, they're completely side by side. And I think Myra pushed already an update to the doc that clarifies that statement. But it's an example of, like, if you don't have context, it's a reasonable question.
Totally. Mono WASM is awesome. Yeah, so I'm actually our WebAssembly PM.
Oh, you are? Congratulations.
Yeah, I have a lot of jobs.
I have feedback.
We are putting together a plan right now on when we're going to ship. We're hoping to ship by the end of the year, but we have not committed to that yet. So I actually wrote a 2 or 3 page document on everything we need to do to ship. That is being reviewed by engineering leadership, by Miguel.
I like the air quote.
Yeah, so we're working through that. But it's a very exciting project. There's a lot of new ground to break because, you know, the way I think about WebAssembly is I think about it just like another chip. So if, you know, imagine we were going to support ARM 128, I'd think about it in the same way. So it's basically WebAssembly is a 32-bit chip that can run in lots of places, but it's specifically in the browser. So that's
the only thing that's special about WebAssembly.
Oh, and it doesn't have threads.
That you run basically in a browser sandbox, right? So like, it's not that you can access everything that you can normally when you run on a new processor, right?
Totally. Like for example. One of the things we're doing is we do have support in the doc, what it's proposing. And by the way, we'll be publishing this hopefully soon publicly. But one of the things we were talking about is, so we're not going to support, say, thread.create. We might even throw in that particular method. But we will support tasks because that's kind of necessary. Right. And so, but we, since there's only one thread always, we basically just have a queue of tasks that we, you know, pull one off and then run it. And
so like a message pump.
Yes, it is like a message pump. Thank you. But this is a very different implementation than is normally used in .NET. So like I documented like a stress approach to validate that we're going to do the right thing. Because my like with the WebAssembly implementation we have, I have high confidence that, you know, you load the thing, it'll always come up. But you can imagine someone in an airport deciding to like write the, you know, all the flights in a WebAssembly app, and you want to make sure that they can have that running for 90 days, for example.
Right.
Whether the browser will stay up for 90 days on its own is a different question. And so we have a stress program that we're looking at to enable those sort of scenarios.
Yeah.
You talk about not having context. Like WASM is something I've been a little bit behind on. But so far you've told me it's 32-bit. It has message pumps. So is it like a Win32 programming model?
Is that what the W stands for?
Do I have a Petzl book for it?
No. So he's badly trolling me. So the cool thing about this chip, I'm sure WASM people are actually like hating this way of thinking about it, but the cool thing about it is you like generate this WASM machine code. It's an independent, it's like an IR independent or machine independent representation, just like IL. But you know, it can run in the browser, on the phone, on a desktop, like any device that has a modern browser can run it. So it's really cool.
I actually do like the chip mentality. I think that's the right place when you're thinking about how to structure your programs and your testing. Like that's the right way to kind of think about how this works.
Yeah, and then there are some app model and environment concerns. Like for example, if your app fundamentally does a lot of I/O or tries to build like a Windows Explorer type experience, then you're going to fail. Like it's not oriented on that kind of application.
Yeah, I think there's two sides, right? There's the code gen aspect, which is like x86 versus x64 kind of thing, right? But I think the problem is that from a customer standpoint, from the end result, it's basically one package, right? There's the different code gen, but then there's also the fact that your runtime or your environment is basically different, right? You're running in a sandbox environment, right? So I think that there's some questions on how many of the .NET standard APIs will actually work to the extent that we can just make them work, right? Threading we can probably not hide, as you said, right? But hopefully some other APIs we can just make work so you don't have to do any sort of special treatment. We will see. Yeah, people ask about our opinions on Electron. You asked the wrong people. We all have strong opinions.
It uses a lot of memory, like all modern software.
Yeah, I will say the Blazor team has done some experiments on that. I don't know what their plans are.
Yeah.
But that would probably be the first thing that we would pull on.
Well, you can maybe don't have to wait for this, but you can already build Electron-based cross-platform applications with .NET, right?
Yep.
The question is whether you like the experience or whether you prefer the reach, right?
And there's a lot of developers who won't build something until there's a Microsoft provided solution.
Like also true. Although like it depends on what you mean by that either, right? Because you can say, you know, we're using it to build VS Code, right? So clearly we are investing in it similar to other
yeah.
things.
I guess I would encourage people to build things even if Microsoft isn't the provider of the stuff.
Oh yeah. Those two statements are both true.
Yeah.
Like I definitely encourage people to, you know, make their own choices, but I've worked with a bunch of big customers who have very strict policies on the sort of software that they're allowed to enable. And it tends to be kind of more the either governments or, you know, huge corps. So,
which is also very often looked down on, which I also don't quite understand, because I mean we do provide very long support, right? So that's I think that is the thing that separates us from many other offerings.
You know, and I think both approaches are fine, meaning they have those policies in place for some very reasonable reasons. So
right, well, you know,
ouch. Somebody says calling my environment trivial. That hurts.
Who said that? Probably you.
I don't think I said
no.
trivial. Did I say trivial? I don't remember.
I don't know.
I don't think I said trivial.
There was another comment saying if you have a trivial environment, I can see how that cannot be a thing.
Oh, okay. So that's not what we said. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. No, I was already thinking we broke into jail already.
Yeah. Somebody mentioned DNX. Where's David Fowler? No, I love DNX.
Oh, source generators. There they go.
Yeah.
That took longer than I thought it would.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to take that one, Jared?
I
could be the bad guy.
Question. No. I could be the bad guy. That's why I'm here.
Jared is the bad guy.
So the question was, in DNX, you had pre-processing hooks where you could modify the source right before compile time. And that's generally referred to as kind of source generators for the C# team. And this is something that we've taken a look at a couple of times in the past, most notably in kind of the C# 7 timeframe. We actually spent a really significant amount of time implementing source generators and kind of going through that. And what we ended up finding is basically that the compiler support is, in terms of complexity, like not that complex. It's actually a pretty small feature. The problem with source generators is actually getting the experience right. Like, what does source generators do for the IDE, for instance? Like, if a source generator gets my entire program as input to generate files, then that means like on every keystroke, do we have to like rebind everything in the IDE? Like, what happens? Like, that is actually like a very big perf problem.
Right.
Yeah.
The build time. There are some issues with build time that we have to work out. But ultimately, with source generators, we kind of ran out of runway in C# 7. Nullable was too big in C# 8. But I get trolled with source generators, I promise you, at least 3 times a week, every week. So I'm confident it's something we're going to look at again in the future.
You're confident we're looking at it. That's great.
Well, I mean, that's the best we can offer with language features.
I mean, it's hard, right? We have a similar problem space in F# with type providers. where for better or for worse, your IDE inherits the failure mode of your data source.
Right.
So if your data source is a web
service. Sounds like device drivers.
Yeah, but like it's challenging because like your IntelliSense, it depends on downloading information from a web service, and maybe there's some problems there, and then all of a sudden your IntelliSense is a little wonky, and then you come knocking at Microsoft Store and you say, hey, why is the F-sharp tooling bad? And then you go, well, what's the issue? And then here's the type provider, and then sometimes it's fine and sometimes it's not, and like it's very complicated to deal with.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the short version is that there's lots of folks for good reasons that want us to enable very complex scenarios. But everyone, even those people, want to still have a very straightforward and simple developer experience.
Exactly. And
those
that's
are
a challenge.
Yeah, and those are sometimes we find a really good path to enable both of those things to be true at the same time.
Yeah.
And then other times it's just incredibly difficult because physics takes over.
I mean, that was how I told your colleague in C++ team yesterday. I said, like, I mean, this is fundamentally a hard problem to solve in C++ because you have macros and templates where effectively it's a form of code generation at compile time, which makes it really hard to have tooling that is always correct and fast and responsive. And like these things are just, at some point you have to decide what is more important to you, right? And I think at some point I got in trouble when I called the C++ IntelliSense IntelliGuess, but like it is true in many cases that you have to cut off at some point and say, okay, it is as good as it can be, but.
Yeah, and then also when you think about like the performance challenge we have, like we really strive to give users the most like correct IntelliSense experience possible in C#, but with source generators, you're now saying that I have to have the output of third-party code to make IntelliSense correct, and like what if they're not very performant? So are we giving like a kind of a mix, like as Philip said, kind of like an up and down IDE experience because sometimes they produce their code fast enough that we can produce it, include it in our IntelliSense, and sometimes they don't. Like, and that's just a real, how do we make it so that the users aren't just completely always confused at what's happening? How do we give them a predictable experience in a world where we can't make guarantees about how fast we can get the data?
It sounds like you need cancellation tokens.
Already got them.
We have a lot of those.
That's cancellation token might be the most used type in all of us. It's like, yeah, no, but it's a consistency issue. Everything can look fine in one environment, and then all of a sudden you just turn on your computer, you try it out, and then it's broken.
That's a good question. So, the one that says question.
Yeah, so the one thing I want to add, though, is like from a, you know, I want to add ref the idea I want source generators, because the thing is, if you look from a framework standpoint, we see it all the time that people do stuff at runtime that they could be doing at build time, but the problem is doing it at build time is super hard today, right? But so like, there's a few examples that we do in the product, right? In the new SDK style projects, we no longer have this assembly info CS file, right? We just generate the assembly infos during build, right? And you can look at how that's being done. It's just a temp CS file that's generated. It's added to the clean list, and then it's injected and blah, blah, blah. And you can do this today. And I mean, there are people that have NuGet packages that try to automate that a little bit. But the thing is, if you want to participate in the build, it's actually quite a lot of work. It's very error prone. It's very easy to get into states where things don't get cleaned up, or you know, you have stale output or whatever. And so people often just say, screw it, I just do reflection and reflection emit at runtime, because that always works. I don't have to inject any artifacts into the build process. But that fundamentally does not play very well when you have things like AOT, or you know, you have smaller devices, or you know, you just pay runtime costs for things that arguably should have been paid at design time already. So it would be great to have a story, but I think that's basically the, you know, the concern that we have.
Agree.
Anyway, so what was the question you said?
I'll read it, but I won't answer it. Can we get the VS templates to all use SDK style projects? I'm putting in my own reflection.
Oh.
Can we get SDK style projects for Visual C++ and other VS languages?
I can answer the first question. No.
Yeah. And tell us why.
So the reason why
I have to take very long lunch breaks. That's the reason.
SDK style uses both use what's called a project system, which you can think of as like an operating system kernel within Visual Studio that just manages tons and tons of different resources. And that kernel that is used for .NET SDK style, although is a lot better than the old one in certain ways, like it's much more responsive, it has kind of everything is asynchronous, there's some new features that are built on top of it, there's like 20 years of features and bug fixes and just legacy things that exist out there that the old one supports and the new one does not. And so you know, you can certainly mix and match, and especially if you're doing new stuff, you can certainly like change your target framework to be .NET framework, and the new SDK style stuff and everything will probably be just fine. But if you're using like SQL projects, flavoring, Xamarin today, things like that, it doesn't even support that. So if we were to change all the VS templates to SDK style projects, we would be
it would break everything.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't break. What it would do is it wouldn't allow you to add new projects to a solution and take a dependency on something that, like, I'd say probably 90% of, in aggregate, our user base depends on in some reason or another.
And this is one of these problems that's not even, it's not complete within our control. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned, there's actually two project systems under the hood that are operating. And Visual Studio is an extensible environment. And that means that, like, whenever we look at ourselves and say that, hey, we have this problem where we depend on very specific behavior of this old one, there are customers out there who write plugins to Visual Studio.
Absolutely.
Who have the exact same problem.
Right.
So it's not just, we can't just solve this problem ourselves. It's something we actually have to go and start working with customers. You guys need to migrate here. This is where we're moving to where we could even think about closing that down.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you may depend on an extension that does not support the new project system and may never support the new project system. And there's, even if we fixed absolutely everything, which would take forever, but say we added support for every single capability in Visual Studio that Microsoft owns, still there would be a subset of users who would be unable to work in that environment.
Yeah. Okay, should we go to another blog post?
We have ran out of the questions. That's nice.
That's mean.
It's a good problem to have, I guess. All right, so talk about Docker for a little bit.
Okay, so this is another post that I wrote. One of the things we've kind of started to do is, so we feel like we're part of the Docker community. So there's a DockerCon in San Francisco every year. And this year it was in April. So we put out a post to coincide with it, and we posted on the first day just to kind of explain what we're doing to advantage the Docker scenario. So this one is basically about, we've really kind of taken this approach to make .NET Core a real container runtime. And there's a few different things that are necessary for that. So you can kind of scroll down and I'll just cover the headings. So one is we've moved to just using less memory by default. So that's definitely a good thing. The other one is that you can specify how much memory a given Docker container should be able to use. So I think the lowest is like 10. It's either like 10 or, yeah, I think it's 10 megabytes. You can go up as basically as high as you want. And so the product now completely honors that and does the right thing. And we've tested it below 100 megabytes and it works. So that's awesome. The next one is you can do the same thing except to CPU. We've done a bunch of work to make sure that the product does the right thing with the CPU. That was actually in some ways harder than the memory one because you have to think about things like the thread pool and make sure that the scheduling that we have in the thread pool has the right notion on how many CPUs are on the machine. And the funny thing about this, and this is what most of all those paragraphs is about, is when you specify the CPU limit for Docker, it's actually like a real number with a decimal. But the thread pool is only oriented on CPUs in terms of integers. So we had to kind of deal with the impedance mismatch between those two things. Another one is we had a bunch of people ask us to add PowerShell to the .NET Core SDK images for like over a year. So we finally did that. We've been working super closely with the PowerShell team. They've been awesome to work with. And so we've enabled that in 3.0. And then we also moved to Microsoft Container Registry. That's where we're pushing our images now. So we still have pages on Docker Hub that tell you what all the images are that that we support. But the registry that we use, basically where the container image blob storage is on in Azure in Microsoft Container Registry. And I think that's basically it. So yeah, so we're super focused on, actually, I guess I'll say one more thing about this. We're super focused on the container scenario. We had gotten a bunch of feedback that said, you know, we weren't quite doing what people wanted. And so that this work is for that. And we'd love to get, you know, more feedback based on 3.0 to tell us where we're still not quite meeting your expectations or where you want improvements. So we are super focused on that.
So one thing I promised to talk about was nullable. So let me just jump to this. It's not a lot of block content, but basically one of the questions we get is like, will the framework support nullable? And like, as you can see here, there's this, if I can get access to my keyboard, there's like three PRs right now, but there's also this really, really tiny number here where I just searched for nullable. So we merged a lot of PRs, so we basically added nullable annotations throughout the BCL. We will not have the whole framework annotated by 3.0. Like, we focused on effectively what we call the core library, which is system.private callable on the implementation side. But it's like publicly facing, there's about 12 DLLs or something like that that basically will be fully annotated by 3.0. And as you can imagine, that's a lot of code. A lot of the code is also fairly low level, which means, you know, we cheat a lot. So the type system has a hard time understanding what we're doing. And so it took us a while to actually plumb them through the implementation. We could have just annotated the public API, but we felt like we don't know whether the public API is correctly annotated if we were to do that. So we basically started with the implementation, then basically bubble up the annotations that our implementation actually uses and what we believe is actually consistent and correct. Okay. So you can see an update by 3.0 where we have that part in there.
Do you expect any bugs from the standpoint that, so say there's some method that you put an annotation on to say whether it can be nullable or not. Do you expect in some cases that customers will realize that you did it incorrectly? And
yeah, so there's a, I think Jared probably also has an opinion on this, but like basically like what it boils down to in some areas, it's kind of like an editorial aspect to it. Like there's not necessarily a clear-cut answer. If you actually think of nullable as a runtime constraint where it's like the true type system actually enforces that, then you wouldn't have the conversation, right? But the reality is our type system does not actually forbid you to use nulls. And in fact, there's many holes, if you will, where you can produce nulls. And we don't try to, like, you know, combat somebody who's malicious. Like, we just try to give you an experience where you can express your intent. Yeah. And the question is, after 15 or 20 years, in our case, what was the intent of object two string, for example, right? So we had a lot of conversations about what annotations that should have and, you know, where we should go with that.
I might want to do that again. Right. This is me combating people.
Your own thing. And I agree with that, the editorial aspect, like the intent. It's, there are some places where the API, it's like if we have an API where 99% of the time this returns non-null. But if you get into this one corner case, you can return null. And this is a behavior you see not in .NET frame, just in .NET framework. You see this all over APIs.
Right.
And it does become a question, an author kind of decision, like what do I put the return value in that case? And the stance that we've taken so far in .NET is I'm going to express the API's intent, not necessarily the tiny, tiny corner case around it. And it's possible that customers will come back to us and say, hey, that's not a tiny corner case. Like, that's actually a bigger corner case than you thought. Yep. And I think when we get that feedback, we'll have to take it in and make decisions on it. Rinse and repeat. But I do expect there to be some back and forth on those decisions. Like, if you look at the questions we had with two string, like, that was a pretty like calm, civil, not contentious debate. And but like we had to do a lot of soul searching. But I do think that took us to a place where now we have a framework to make those decisions going forward.
Right.
But it is going to take customer feedback to tell us ultimately, like, if we made the right choices in those cases.
So this really seems like a blog post in terms of
what
was the editorial. Yes, it's definitely.
Well, so I mean, there's a few dimensions here that I think we need to probably blog about. Like, first of it is like the in which context can I use it dimension, and then there's the, you know, certainly from Microsoft's perspective, you know, this. We're not typically in the business of giving you more warnings, but the goal of this feature is to give you warnings if you're doing things that are considered unsafe. And those warnings are going to roll out more and more over time. You know, as more things get annotated, more things that Microsoft owns get annotated. And so how do we think about the fact that if we ship an update, we're effectively shipping additional warnings to people? And so sort of what are the tools to deal with that? How do people feel about that sort of thing? I think it's at some point we're going to have to come out with broader messaging on that.
Yeah.
And the fact that even, you know, if absolutely everything was perfectly annotated in terms of what we owned and what we shipped, there's still going to be latent adoption from third-party packages and things like that.
Yeah.
And so as people start absorbing that stuff, like how does that all?
Yeah, I mean, like, we haven't published it yet, but I mean, our current line of thinking is basically 3.0, we will ship annotations for basically the bottom stack of .NET, not all of the BCL, but the bottom part of it. And then our goal is to get most, if not all of the annotations in by 5.0, meaning we have basically a year to get them in. So within that year, basically we will block when we ship 3.0. And it's basically a call to action for library authors to get their libraries to actually enable nullability annotations as well. And so the idea is that by the time, you know, between 3.0 and 5.0, it's basically the platform providers and the library authors who are basically having to do some ramp up time, so that by 5.0, when most application authors will start opting into this or, you know, other things, then, you know, we have more and more stuff annotated, right? So that's kind of, no matter what time frame we pick, eventually we have to ship something stable that by definition must be incomplete because we don't own the entirety of the .NET ecosystem, right? So, and we feel like this 3.0 to 5.0 roughly a year is probably a good time frame to get, you know, at least some significant portion of the ecosystem, you know, the James Newton Kings of the world, the JSON.NETs, right? But it will probably still have a very long tail that will probably take probably 5 to 10 years realistically to get everything annotated, right?
Yeah.
And some things will probably never be annotated because it's nobody's, you know, it's not worth the time.
So that's a good question. How do annotations work with respect to, I don't think he means overloading. I think he means overriding.
Overriding, but,
yeah.
It's a language lawyer.
Oh, a language lawyer question. So the annotations in general, like for instance, like when you're talking about the nullability of the question marks, they have the same rules as like Cohen. They're basically, we allow overriding in Cohen contravariant ways. So you can take, for instance, a method that has a string question return, and you can override it with a method that just returns string question. And that's just basic substitution principles. It's, you're making the contract stronger, not weaker. In the same way, if you have a method which takes a string, a normal string, you can override it with one that takes string question, because you're just, once again, expanding the inputs to a method or shrinking the outputs to a method.
Yep.
So if you're familiar with the rules of Cohen contravariance, you can pretty much apply them to nullability and overriding.
So nothing new.
No, nothing new. Same thing, just applied to a new.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, that's what people already do in implementation, right? You can totally override and accept, you know, different inputs, right? Will .NET Standard 2.0 come out at the same time as .NET Core 3.0? Yes. Should we still target .NET Standard? I think you're probably asking for 2.0, would be my guess. I mean, .NET Standard will be a thing for a very long time. Like, we already said the .NET Framework 4.8 will still implement .NET Standard 2.0 only. So 2.1 basically means you're effectively only on the, you know, the .NET Core-based platforms moving forward, if you will. But we don't have a converged stack yet, right? So even if you want to share today or in foreseeable future code between, let's say, Xamarin and .NET Core, the way you do this is by authoring a .NET Standard-based library. We don't have a story that, you know, you just target .NET Core app and then magically it works everywhere. We don't have that.
Yeah, so .NET Standard remains relevant for a long period of time. I think the other question is whether or not we're going to create new versions past 2.1.
Yeah, I think that's something we are discussing. I think my personal viewpoint is that eventually we will stop doing .NET Standard for sure. The question is it 2.1, is it 2.2? That kind of depends on how much work we can get in before that. But I think the idea is that given that we have a converged platform, I think the intent would be that that is the one that you just target.
Right. So there might be just one tiny piece of context that people might be missing, even though we've danced around it, which is our hope and plan is to have one target framework going forward that is used for all types of applications.
Yeah. So the tricky thing is we have to think about how we allow people to still write pound if code, right? Where they say pound if iOS, I call some iOS API, pound if Android, I call some Android API, right? So we still have to enable multi-targeting in some meaningful fashion, and that is the thing something we don't have.
Well, and also if there's a way to do those, that write that same code with runtime checks,
right?
That's another discussion.
That is correct. So then I would just want to wrap this up really quickly. So there's one more item that I think Philip should probably talk to because it's actually quite cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm actually, I was triaging something on there already. So this repository, because it's called .NET/F#, for anybody who has been doing F# stuff on GitHub for a while, it used to be called Microsoft/Visual F#. That's sort of a name that it was given in 2014. And that was done in part due to the fact that there was kind of like a rather large, as you could say, split between the notion of what is F-sharp and what is Visual F-sharp. There was F-sharp, the language, mm-hmm. with a compiler that did a bunch of stuff independently of Microsoft, a bunch of things that were open source. There was a big community. There were alternative packagings to F-sharp that were not only on Windows. And then there was Visual F-sharp, which was Microsoft packaging F-sharp for consumption on Windows through Visual Studio. And that was basically it. And there's kind of historically been a tension there where a lot of F-sharp developers were like, but I want to deploy on a non-Windows machine. Yeah, but for, you know, it's not that there was like this active hostility towards the idea of it. It's just the priorities were surrounded, were basically surrounding Windows and Visual Studio. And that's just not really the reality for F-sharp anymore. I mean, we view Windows and Visual Studio as an important operating system and development environment for F-sharp, but not the only operating system and the only development environment that we care about. Mm-hmm. And certainly with the rise of .NET Core and usage of F-sharp on .NET Core.
Sounds like the rise of the Terminators.
Rise of the Terminators, yeah. You know, it just kind of felt weird to have this Microsoft / Visual F-sharp repository when everything that we were doing was sort of in the context of helping F-sharp, the language, grow and take non-Windows, non-Visual Studio environments seriously. And, you know, not be like a Microsoft thing so much as a .NET thing. And we felt that, you know, making the change to our repository and being a part of the .NET Foundation was very well aligned with that. It's also less stuff for me to type in a URL. So I like that.
That is certainly cool.
Yeah, maybe we should think about moving some other projects.
Microsoft / MS Build.
Yeah, right? that was the one that came to mind. We actually discussed this at the time. Because Emo and I worked on open sourcing that. And it kind of went 50-50, and maybe we made the wrong choice.
We've been talking about that decision over the last few nights, and it might be revisited soon. We'll see.
I mean, Jared, you have the permissions in both the Microsoft and .NET organization.
Yeah.
You can do it right now.
Yeah. There's nothing like Philip sending me a message. He's like, hey, man, can you move F-sharp to .NET? Like on GitHub?
Yeah.
Does Don know? Is Don going to be upset with me when I do this?
Yeah, I didn't talk about that, nor did I talk about it in the blog post that corresponded with this. But we worked with some community members and wrote an RFC sort of detailing what we were going to do and why. And we got, you know, the community on board with it. We got buy-off from everybody within Microsoft. And it was like, all right, it's time. And none of us had the permissions to actually move the repository. And so I sent some emails around and nobody was answering. So then I just pinged Jared and I'm like, hey, Jared, do you have admin permissions within Microsoft and .NET? He's like, yeah. I'm like, hey, move this repository. And he's like,
I'm glad you're saying on air whose accounts should be hacked from the outside. Thank you for doing that.
I don't think he has admin across all of Microsoft. I think he had admin to our repo.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, and Jared's like, wait a minute, who's gonna get mad at me for doing this?
Yeah. I only have one question for you. Can you explain this to me?
Property pages.
Oh, it's the property pages.
Visual Basic is the best programming language for implementing property pages in Visual Studio. And I say that with a straight face. I'm dead serious.
How much rich text formatting do you
have? Freaking licenses.
7.7%,
third-party notice files. That's my guess.
Yeah.
I
hate RTF files.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up using those as a child, mm-hmm. Which is now the way.
That's 60 years ago?
Yeah, 60 years ago. horrible stuff.
The question about SourceLink there. I thought we had SourceLink enabled in CoreFX now.
We do. I'm not sure we ship with that in all cases. I don't think it's across the board. I had the same reaction. I think the plan for 3.0 is to make usage across the board, but I need to double check that.
We should ask Tomash.
Yeah, I think that was the... Yeah.
Okay, are we...
So I think the only one, do you want to talk about this, Philip, or do you want to...
Oh, yeah, just one last thing from the F-sharp perspective. So if you are using F-sharp in a non-Windows, or, you know, maybe Windows, but non-Visual Studio environment, as I referred to earlier, you're likely using the iNode plugin, or there's a good chance you're using the iNode plugin with Visual Studio Code. We've been working with Christoph, one of the primary maintainers, to sort of figure out what the next version of INIDE looks like 4.0. A big one is language server protocol support, which he recently implemented, and you know, we want to roll out, try to make things default more to .NET Core from a tooling standpoint, improve the project scaffolding stuff to sort of be a bit simpler, because today project scaffolding support in INIDE is sort of like, it comes with everything, and it's really good if you're an expert. But if you're brand new, and we sort of verify this with user studies, you people who are brand new to F# kind of freak out because there's all these, you know, there's Fake, there's Packet, there's a few other tools that come with it. And it's really great if you know what all of that stuff is, but if you don't know what any of it is, it's like a little overwhelming. And so, you know, there's ways that we can tweak that. You know, we don't have to throw the baby out with bathwater, but we can make that better. And so he has like a checklist here that he's just kind of working through, and sort of once that's all finished, he's going to release INIDE 4.0, and it's going to be pretty awesome. There's also an experimental version of INIDE where basically as every single one of these items becomes available, it's going to be put in the experimental plugin just so that people can use it and report bugs and things like that. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, the one thing I want to add is, like, I don't know whether you saw this on GitHub, but they added this button here.
Oh, I hadn't seen it yet.
Great. That's.
I'm glad you. I'm glad that it's like we're against the sponsorship. Button.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know.
If somebody screenshots this, it's like Microsoft is against sponsoring.
You can sponsor individual developers. Yeah. Actually, something. Right there. So he set this up to go to the Open Collective sponsorship that he established for INIDE. Because rather than sponsoring like him personally, there are other people who work on it. And so the Open Collective link will take you to a basically Open Collective acts as a 501c3, I think. And they hold funds, and they dispense them to the project rather than an individual. And whenever an individual says, oh, I'm going to withdraw some money because, you know, say I want to pay for my living expenses while I do open source development, it's a fully transparent thing. Like, you get a if you're a backer, you get a notification every time somebody withdraws money, and you can see the invoice amount. And it's pretty radical. So it's pretty good.
That sounds like socialism.
Let's not get into that.
On that note, I think this was all we had for today, because we are already 7 minutes over.
And you're supposed to be somewhere else.
I'm supposed to sit in a JSON API review right now.
Who's so Jason?
Jason?
It's Which
he's,
one?
He's the brother of James Newton King.
Okay. Jason Newton King.
Jason Newton King, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, then I think that's it for today, and then hope to see you in, I think, beyond in 3 weeks again, because I think we shifted the whole thing a little bit, but we'll see. It's either 3 weeks or 4 weeks. All right,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.